register your team at raceforkids.ca or find us on Facebook.
The evolution continues. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
Vibe Collective.
We have an intro.
It's radio and we have an intro. Yes, it's the Vibe Collective here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I am Jams. Joining me in studio,
Mally, aka Docu Vixen.
Adrian Morrell.
Meme.
Yeah. Also known as Kemba King. We're the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we have roundtable talks. We talk about important issues like social justice, decolonization, the culture of resistance, identity.
Environmental racism.
Yes. Anybody else?
Crack cocaine.
this week, for sure, we will be talking about that.
Yes! Yes! It's a circus now. I don't know.
We talk about circuses all the time. Political circuses.
The circus now, you say.
Yeah.
The continuing
circus. Ongoing saga of the circus that is our political system. And then from 4 to 5, we bring you music to move you. DJs Griffin and myself, DJ Jams, will be doing that later on in the show. But first, we do have a very special guest in studio with us.
Sorry.
Here to talk about her residency in Turkey. Kemba, do you want to introduce?
I don't want to introduce Bishara. Bishara Muhammad is an artist who works in very different disciplines, and she's well-versed and articulate in different political arenas. And I would like you, Bishara, to add anything else that I missed.
I think that's all good.
Oh.
Yeah. Thank you.
Wonderful. I did that off the top of my head.
Nice. Very good. So Bishara is here today to talk about your residency in Turkey and the work that you're doing around the Somali alphabet. Mm-hmm. And welcome to the Vibe Collective.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. And we also have some guests out in the hall who will be coming in to observe. Observe the herd.
We're putting in a succession plan.
Yes.
Yes. Bishara, it's really great to have you here. And I guess maybe if you could just talk about the residency, what made you apply for it, and then the work that you plan to do there.
Okay. Thank you for having me as well. I appreciate being here. So I applied for the residency because it's basically kind of a special, like where it is kind of a special location. It's in Cappadocia in Turkey, which is in central Turkey, and the people there have lived in cave homes. And this residency, they've restored those cave homes into artist studios. So I applied for it because I had this idea of basically developing and researching and developing a new Somali alphabet. And I thought it kind of fit in terms of like this similarity or parallel between like ancient people developing languages in caves and then myself developing a language in a cave.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask because I know that I did a little bit of research before the show today and looking at the Somali alphabet, and I saw There are three different alphabets right now. Mm-hmm. One is Arabic based, the other is Latin based, and then the third one was Somali based. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, for the longest time, the Somali languages existed without an alphabet. Okay. And it was documented, like in terms of what was documented, was written in Arabic for a long time, but just made to fit around the Somali language. And there was three attempts to make a new Somali, to make an alphabet. And the first two were in the 1920s and 30s. In the 1920s, it was Osmania. This guy developed a script that looked similar to the Ge'ez alphabet, and it looked very similar. In the 1930s, it was Borama, which looked more like numbers, and neither of those caught on for all kinds of reasons. And the third one was a Latin-based alphabet that the Somali language kind of was to be fit around, like to go around it, kind of. But this is, I think it's interesting because there's like letters that are missing in both languages. Like there's no P or V in Somali, and then there's these long vowels that exist in the Somali language that don't exist in the English language.
Can you talk about why this project is important to you?
It's important to me because language is important, both spoken and written, but they're both important in terms of communicating, but written language is important in terms of recording, documenting. And it's important to me because in terms of how the Somali language is written now and how documents have been stored within the last 30, 40 years, there is always kind of a mistranslation or a lack in terms of like extra letters being added and letters being taken away that didn't make any sense to me. Maybe it didn't make sense to other people as well. And so it's important for me because I want to develop something that is African in origin and fits the language and syncs with it rather than taking something that's colonial to fit around the language and then losing elements of it in the gaps, like the mouth movements.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, I just have to say that the music is very... I thought someone was breathing hard into the mic and then I realized it was the music. So can you talk about your work throughout your career as an artist? And
it's Adrian. He's a nose breather.
I actually thought it was him. I'm like, no, it's not him.
Figures, right? First, when you look at it. All right. Okay. Okay.
So looking at your work throughout your career as an artist's career, I put in quotes.
Yeah.
Because that was the word that came out. How can you talk about the work that you have done over those years and how you feel like this may be an extension or a culmination of that work?
Definitely. The work that I've been doing for a long time was very heavily based in storytelling. Mm. So storytelling traditions and looking at different topics such as like race and migration and belonging and language. Language was a big theme in my work for a long time and still is. And history and like oral history as well as written history, which is also language, but it's also culture. And so, I mean, I think it's kind of interesting in terms of the work that I've been doing before and the work that I'm doing alongside this project kind of fits into this trajectory of where my work is going.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess a long time ago when I was in university, I was having this conversation and I used the adjective Somali and I was corrected. Mm-hmm. And I should have said Somalian because the adjective Somali is specific to a particular region within Somalia. Can you talk about that and your relationship to using Somali versus Somalian?
Yeah, definitely. So Somali is kind of, it's a language group, but it's also an ethnic group.
Right.
And I think in terms of like I don't know, an English-speaking way of understanding people coming from a place like Trinidadian or like Jamaican got translated to Somali people.
Okay.
So Somalian kind of became this thing.
Okay.
Similar to, like, I've heard people say Pakistanian before and was like,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's similar to that.
Yeah.
And do you feel like that sort of distinction affects how your work will be done in Turkey?
Mm-hmm. I definitely think that distinction affects how my work will be done in Turkey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you anticipate how?
I can't. It's hard to anticipate because I don't, like, I'm trying not to have too much expectations.
Okay.
Because, I don't know, I get pretty miserable when I have these expectations and...
Right.
They're not met.
No, that makes complete sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the residency itself and how, why you applied for this particular residency and how long you'll be there?
This is kind of silly, but I've always wanted to live in a cave.
That's not silly at all.
And so when I came across this place that it's called Babayan Culture House, that was just restored cave houses, I thought about which project would be kind of site specific for me to work with there. And there's a lot of project ideas I have, but the one that seemed to fit the best was the language project. And I've forgotten what you've asked me.
Well, yeah, just to talk about the residency itself and how long will you spend in the cave and anything else about
it? A month and a week. So I'll be there from August till September, till like mid-September.
Mm. Wow. So I was thinking your work is involving mapping phonemes onto a set of signs that you're going to create or... is that what's happening in terms of building the alphabet?
Just like attaching symbols to sounds?
Correct, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's exactly what's happening.
Okay. Yeah. So, and where are you going to get the signs from?
I'm going to look at the Ge'ez alphabet as well as the Osmani alphabet. Unfortunately, a lot of African languages, the alphabets that they use are the alphabets of the colonizers.
Mm-hmm.
I want to find other African alphabets that are African in origin, but there's not very much.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, outside of Arabic.
Which is also a colonizing language.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And in terms of like spreading the script, in a sense,
mm-hmm.
what are some of the avenues you intend to use?
I'm glad you asked me that. I already have some plans. I want to do something like an instructional video of writing how to write the script.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also thinking of doing some stuff like really kind of old school stuff, like woodblock carving and like woodblock carving the scripts out so that it could be printed, kind of.
Oh, yeah, like stamps, kind of.
Yeah, like stamps, or how people used to write.
Right. Yeah.
I'm thinking about, I guess, the politics around language and you making a decision actually to do this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I know you don't have any expectations around the project, but I'm just wondering if you've anticipated how it will be received within your community.
Oh, I'm glad you asked me that too. I do have some kind of anticipation of how it will be received in my community. I don't know if the reception is going to be a good reception or not, but I'm more afraid in terms of like the reception from my community as opposed to the reception from other communities.
Right.
And one of the places that I want to show this or spread it, hopefully, is in Mogadishu.
Mm-hmm.
But I was challenged, and it was a challenge that I welcomed, where some Somali folks were like, Mogadishu is not the center of the world. It's not the only place in Somalia, and it's not the only place where Somalis live. And
and
with that, I welcome any Somali people who have access to spaces to spread this as well. The reason why I chose Mogadishu is because my grandmother has a house there that's still standing.
Right.
And I have access to that.
Right.
So other spaces that I may get access to through other people, I welcome that.
So basically saying, like, bring me in.
Yeah, pretty much.
And I'll deal with it, right?
Yeah.
I'm just thinking because, like, it's pretty big, right?
Right.
Like, 100 years from now, it'd be like Bishara Muhammad, you know, like, created an alphabet for Somali.
It'll be known as the Bishara alphabet.
I don't want to put my name on a script, though.
and,
And why? Like is that an artistic thing?
You don't have to worry. I'm gracious enough to take your credit. It's called the Adrian script.
Oh my god!
I'm humble like that.
Yeah. That's really big of you.
I try.
I try. I appreciate that.
I'm growing each day.
You're about to lose your feminist card. You're about to lose your feminist card.
Lose?
No, so but in all seriousness, why would that be something that would be problematic for you?
It's not really problematic. I think it's just it's not something like I'm not shying away from making the alphabet, mm-hmm. and I'm not shying away from being the person known as developing the alphabet. But I think I'm shying away from attaching my name to it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think it's an ego thing that I'm just having a problem with.
Yeah. I guess for me, because I feel like it's important, right? Mm-hmm. Like you, you know, spiritually, culturally, emotionally deciding to do this work, mm-hmm. right? It's something that you should be recognized, right? So, mm-hmm. and, you know, people of color and indigenous community members, we need our names on things
mm-hmm.
so that, you know, we can know where it has originated from. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's why I'm just kind of like really pushing you to understand why that is, right?
Yeah, thank you for challenging me in that way.
No problem.
Especially as a woman mm-hmm. of color, right? Having your name attached to an alphabet, I think it's kind of powerful.
Yeah.
My question is sort of in developing, or like what would be your starting point? And where would you begin? Like, it just seems overwhelming to me, right? So,
mm-hmm.
And then also, what is sort of the relationship with other indigenous languages
mm-hmm.
that have been, you know, gone through similar things in this sort of time? Yeah.
Other indigenous languages that you speak?
Well, like, the reason why I bring that up is because, you know, I've been told by, you know, Ojibwe people that mm-hmm. Somali is very similar,
oh.
like in the rhythm and all this kind of stuff.
Oh,
so I'm just saying, like, a lot of indigenous languages, they've gone through the similar process of creating some kind of alphabet. So I don't know, is that part of your process of start, like your starting point? Like, yeah, more what is your starting point in creating?
There's one artist actually who's an inspiration of mine. I haven't looked into indigenous languages in terms of how alphabets were created, but I think that's also something I'm going to include in my research.
Right.
But there's one artist who's an inspiration of mine, and I think he's made in his life, I don't know how old he is, he's an older man, and in his life I think he's made about 5 or 7 alphabets.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm impressed as well. And one of the first one that he did was basically, he's a Chinese guy.
Mm-hmm.
The first one he did was basically taking different characters in the Chinese alphabet, like different Chinese characters, and taking elements of one and another and then putting them together separately
mm-hmm.
to make something new. And I think that's a really interesting collage kind of way of approaching creating something new from something old.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be looking at Osmaniya and I'm going to be looking at Gaze, and I know Osmaniya looks a lot like Gaze. So those will be the two languages, alphabets actually, that I'll be referencing and maybe even collaging
right.
the most.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Can you talk about the artwork that you used on your Indiegogo site? What's the significance of that?
Okay.
And maybe you can describe it for people who aren't here.
Okay. So they're both based on African creation stories from different nations. And one is a man climbing a spider web, and there's a spider in the corner. And another one is a person throwing up the universe. Basically, this is from another series, that I'm also working on called the Points of Origin series, which is looking at and examining points of origins for Africans
mm-hmm.
and Black people, so
mm-hmm.
points of origins of Blackness, because in terms of, I'm a big fan of mythology, but I've always noticed the lack of
mm-hmm.
African mythology
mm-hmm.
included into mainstream mythology,
yeah.
and how well-versed I was as a teenager and young adult in terms of Greek mythology and Roman mythology, but I knew nothing about African nations, mythologies, creation stories, all of that. So this is just my way of inserting these into I don't know if it's the mainstream, but inserting them into the public's eye.
Yeah, I think this, to pick up on that point, I remember conversing with a friend. Like, imagine, like, could you imagine, like, an Africanized version of Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings, right? Yeah. And how many people would actually go for that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, without all the stigma. So, like, the idea of how mythology is kind of, you know, there's a hierarchy within mythology. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is linked to language because most of the creation myths have a story of how language came about, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, exactly, some degree, yeah.
Who brought language, right? Yeah. But what I find fascinating is that I remember growing up and just thinking, like, the script that we had, I thought, like, you know, it fell from the sky or something. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like, it was just always here.
Right.
But the idea that these things are constructed and they're made, and you know someone who's making one now, I think is really, really eye-opening, you know?
Yeah.
And it takes a little bit away from, maybe just speaking from my experience, but that kind of, like, the universality of the kind of colonial European experience, whereas... Mm-hmm. This script came from someplace too, like the ABCD. You mm-hmm. know, it came from, I think it was old runes or something like that, and mixed with the Romans or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so, recognizing that these things, again, like so many elements that we take, not everybody, but a lot of people take as just carved in stone was always here,
mm-hmm.
people made them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as we're going forward in our journeys in terms of decolonizing, or, you know, kind of envisioning a different future or a better future, we can make stuff up too.
Mm-hmm, right? Exactly. Yeah,
and validating what it means to, quote, make stuff up, right? Like,
yeah.
I know there's this kind of discussion with African-American communities about the certain names of late that come up and how it's seen.
Could you give some examples of
those names? No, I'm not doing that with you. It's just like the just like the dance hall beat. Not
wow.
doing that with you.
Wow.
But I'm just saying, like, this, there's a space of, like, invalidating those names mm-hmm. because they are made up and they didn't come from somewhere, mm-hmm. quote unquote. So I think that's a very good point that you made, Adrian.
Yeah, history mm-hmm. is constantly making and remaking itself, right? Somebody made up John,
yes.
right? Somebody
yeah.
made up Peter. Like,
yeah.
you know, this
yeah.
it comes from someplace. So
yeah.
why is it that those creations are held up as standard and valid and,
mm-hmm.
you know, the names I'm not going to say because Campbell's giving me that look again. you know, those things don't have the same type of value. So, like, questioning those types of constructions and
mm-hmm.
how constructions are... can be useful and recreated mm-hmm. and put to our own purposes.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Exactly.
Can you...
I just wanted to, you know, talk about, like, I guess what brought up for me was, like, how storytelling,
mm.
you know, creates our whole kind of world, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
right.
So if you go with that kind of thing, then we could actually create a reality ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're told that this is a story and it's been like that for, like, the whole time,
yeah.
it's easier to control sort of that reality.
Mm-hmm.
That was a random thought.
No, it fits.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, just, you know, having been a fan of your work for a long time, how you feel like the Alphabet Project connects to your work around constructions of home.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. So language has a lot to do with homeland,
mm-hmm.
And homeland in terms of, like, language speakers can be displaced, but mm. their connection to homeland is their language.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that I think of often because I'm losing my language. Mm. Like, I'm losing words in Somali that I'm constantly calling my mom up and being like, how do you say art?
Mm-hmm.
Or how do you...
Okay.
Yeah, and so these things are kind of like, even though I haven't been home,
mm-hmm.
wherever that is, in a long time,
right.
My connection to it is slowly being lost.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is my attempt to basically immerse myself in a way of creating a language that is my home
right.
and creating my home at the same time.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, it does.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, what little bit I know about the Somalian community in Toronto, I think that might be important for many folks as well. And I'm seeing that your work could be important for, you know, them in addition to other diasporic communities
mm-hmm.
in Toronto and the greater Toronto area.
Definitely. It makes me think of, I know learning, I learned Oneida, which is very close to Mohawk.
Mm.
I have a Mohawk background. And one of the things that I hear often from not just Haudenosaunee communities, but a lot of different indigenous communities here on Turtle Island, is that language is from the land.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about that all the time, because when you think about different accents, mm-hmm. right, like in the States, mm-hmm. you know, depending on where on the land people live, they'll have a different accent. Even here in Toronto, mm-hmm. depending on which neighborhood you're from, if you have you can tell. And mm-hmm. and I find that really, really interesting in terms of linguistics and connection to language and mm-hmm. connection to land. And then of course from there comes connection to identity mm-hmm. and nationhood. So do you think you can speak a little bit about that in terms of doing this work? And you're doing it in a cave, which I think is really interesting with regards to that connection to land, although it is in Turkey, not in Somalia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not sure what to say. Sorry, can you repeat your question?
I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on the connection to land and language.
Mm. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of connection between land and language in terms of how language is spoken. I think it does come from the land, but I think it also comes from the people, and I think it's one of those things that's like the chicken or the egg, like mm. it's circular. In terms of like how it's spoken and how it's written, is very connected to the people that are from wherever they're from, and that's their language. And then when they're removed from where they're from, their connection to being displaced or whatever is their language. So a lot of the times how people lose their identities is their language. Mm. And this was made up, like this is apparent through like the transatlantic slave trade as well as the East African slave trade. And in terms of like names, because names also have a lot to do with language. And so when people lose like how they speak and how they are identified by other people, they lose the connection of the lands that they came from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think it's there's something really poignant in taking something like an alphabet and looking at how, you know, symbols can be applied to that in a non-Eurocentric way. Mm-hmm. And also I find it really, really poignant that you're doing this in a cave. I just can't I can't get out of the cave.
I'm excited by that too. And I also wanted to add to what I just said, that it's language, names, and stories. And those are all ways that we basically like communicate with one another. And when we lose stories, when we lose language, when we lose names, it's usually when we lose who we are, or like we forget who we are. And that's when new narratives, and these are the enforced narratives, can be put into you.
And I think this is really important in terms of the effects of historical trauma, intergenerational trauma, like mm-hmm. us from various communities of that have been oppressed and colonized, mm-hmm. how we reclaim our identity, right, mm-hmm. through naming and storytelling mm-hmm. as well. I wanted to ask, you know, if people want to get more information on your work or how they can support you going to Turkey. Can you mm-hmm. talk about that?
Well, I have an Indiegogo campaign mm-hmm. up and running. It will end by June 20th. And it's a fixed campaign, so it's kind of high pressure. Mm-hmm. so that, like, that's one way to learn more about this project. I also have a blog.
Can you tell them what the Indiegogo site is?
Oh, it's called the Alphabet Project in Turkey. Yeah, that's it. I also have a blog, which is sharamohammed.blogspot. I haven't updated it in a while, but some of my old work is up there, so you could see that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to go to a very, very brief break. Would you like to stick around? I think we're probably going to get into some Toronto politics. And there is a connection to Somalia that I actually have a question for you related to the political situation here in Toronto.
Okay.
Are you okay to stick around? Okay, and then we can talk a little bit more about your project on the other side of the break. It's going to be very brief. You're listening to The Vibe Collective here on CIUT 89.5 FM, and we'll be back after this brief break.
evolution continues. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
And we're back on the Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM. And we have been speaking with Bashara Muhammad, who is doing a residency in a cave in Turkey coming up in August, which is about the coolest thing ever.
Especially knowing Bashara. Like, if you know Bashara, like, that's like,
so cool.
It's just so cool. It like, me, me and the cave people would be like...
I think you could pull it off.
It's just like the cave, but the thing, I want to talk a little bit about the cave. It's just...
I know, me too. I want to talk about the cave too. Let's go
it's
in.
It's just, I'm just thinking of like, you know, how, you know, art was created, you know, like the first art scene on like cave walls. You know what I mean? Like it's something magical about that. So, yeah.
Something very magical about it. Yeah.
Yeah. All I got is Bruce Wayne. I'm just thinking like something like decked out. Like
I'm lost.
Bruce Wayne, Batman.
Batcave.
It's in a cave.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of human history and pop culture in caves.
It seems so.
Yeah. Clearly, I'm not into pop culture. Sorry.
So while we're on the subject of caves, it brings me to think of, you know, the how some people might describe someone like Rob Ford as a caveman.
That was a good transition. I'm impressed. Yeah.
Thank you. I just thought of it now.
Freestyle.
So, in case anybody has been just emerging from a cave, Rob Rob Ford was accused. He's allegedly been filmed smoking crack cocaine.
Well, they said you couldn't tell what was actually in the pipe if it was actually him.
And so you know what I already said from jump. They're going to say it was medicinal marijuana.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, because, you know, it's the lesser of all evils in a pipe, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, so he's allegedly been filmed. Although the way it was described,
it
sounds like you couldn't really try and excuse it as marijuana because of the way the pipe was being lit from underneath.
It was very specific.
Very, very graphically described by all three of the journalists who witnessed it.
So okay, can I just say something,
right? Please.
I know that someone who is addicted to crack, you know, they are living with an addiction and people have addictions, right? Rob Ford has done some really terrible things throughout the course of his political career, as documented on several websites and media outlets. Even if it is crack and he's smoking it, Is he going to get booted out of office?
No.
So what am I putting my money into that
like,
for? You know what I mean?
It's
it'll
like
be interesting
media
to see.
Circus. Yeah.
Right?
Media circus. Like, that's all it is. Like,
I know. If anything, he'll start to get empathy, right?
No, and he's already getting that.
He's got an addiction.
It's ensuring his re-election right now.
See, you guys just keep going after my boy, and he just comes back stronger
every single time. People are like, nobody can get him down.
You can't get him down, man. You can't knock 40 out, man.
But and meanwhile, what's going on at City Hall? Like,
well, I think it's the bigger picture. Like, yeah. But one thing I do want to point out is he is clearly a colleague, a chosen colleague of Stephen Harper. Mm. And I just want to point out that there's a pattern with Stephen Harper's lackeys. One by one, they seem to self-destruct. Mm-hmm. One by one.
Oh, yes.
Right? Yes. Which is kind of... amazing. But what's so frustrating is what you guys are saying is so true. I mean, you know, here Rob Ford has now been allegedly filmed smoking crack cocaine, but
I'm more concerned about the homophobia and the racism that he is alleged to have displayed in this
during the video.
But it smells crack, I don't care.
But my point is
I'm like, yeah, that's the least of my
worries. I kinda care. He's the mayor.
And, well, you probably don't want your mayor smoking
but
crack.
But he He abuses alcohol. He has been on record as allegedly abusing his partner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I mean, like,
he has some oxy.
And he had an
oxy, right?
I thought he had a cocaine charge against him back
and
in
also
the
alcoholism.
Yeah. It was dropped.
It was
DUI. He got a DUI,
but he had yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but my
so
whole
he likes
thing
his chemistry set. In other words,
yeah.
And why did he choose coke crack that day? I don't know. That's nothing. Like, we shouldn't even discuss that. It's kind of absurd.
No, but my whole thing is that, you know, with some of the other Harper lackeys, you know, they self-destructed and then that was it. They were done. Like Brazeau, Flanagan, that was down in flames, Flanagan. And what's his name? Flaherty. And, you know, it's one by one they have this sort of moment of like, oh, scandal, self-destruction. But with Rob Ford, as you all are saying, like, it's really not going to make much of a difference. So what my question is, why are some able to, like, you know, go down in a ball of flames and then that's the last we hear or see of them? But with Ford, there's this, like, I don't know, super glue sticking him to his chair.
Ford's able to project a kind of every man type of vibe, you know? So people...
I just want to let people know that Adrian put up his quotation marks.
I had the bunny ear quotes, every man, because there's nothing every populist about this guy. He grew up stinking rich, right?
Yeah.
But he's able to present that. And so people are like, oh, man, that guy reminds me of my uncle. Or that guy reminds me of whomever else. And so
my creepy neighbor.
Yeah. You know, and also I think too is like he's very clearly not polished, right? So where you have a lot of kind of like slick politicians who always say the right thing, and you know they make the right faces at the right time. This guy has no clue as to how to do that, right? He just gives you the straight, and it's like if it's wrong, if it's meant, you get the illusion of sincerity, right? From Rob Ford, I think a lot of people gravitate toward that because a lot of other people are so well rehearsed, and he's clearly not.
Yeah, I wouldn't say sincerity. I would say more tactless.
Well, I mean,
yes, I would back you up with that.
But I think
they often pass. You know, like if someone just comes across as like a kind of boorish type of personality, you're thinking, well, that's how this person really is. So they'd be refined. Mm-hmm. You know, it's people who are refined and reserved who I think most people are going to look at and say, well, this person's, you know, they're practiced. Mm-hmm. This guy's just speaking from his heart. And sometimes he's wrong, but you know, you're getting the real from Rob Ford.
Yeah, sincerity being synonymous with real and authentic, as opposed to genuine in a nice kind of way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But he's also a known liar, so I don't know how real that
lie.
Is.
Everybody,
that's true.
Everybody
yeah, I know.
Lies.
That's true. I'm just saying. You know, he's been caught in his lie. So my point is, I just don't know how real he is.
Oh, I don't think he's real. But I mean, that's the image he projects.
But he lies to the point where we know he's lying.
No, yeah, but I think also he's framed as this underdog, right? Mm. And people like the underdog.
This is true,
yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, everybody's against him, like all these people, like, you know, so I think
that's what
people
like. Oh, yeah, he tried to blame it on
like
the star, on their agenda against him.
Yeah.
Why not? Because, you know, it's really about talking to your supporters. It's not about the truth. It's like, what will the people who support you believe? Those lefties at the star are out to get me. Yeah, that sounds real. And then that's it. It doesn't really have to go much further. That's what they'll believe, you know? So he, even though he's kind of bumbling, he knows what he's doing. And when he's on, I've seen him in debates and he's like shredded people, you know?
Really?
So it's not like he's completely like out to, you know, he knows kind of what he's doing. He was raised in a political family. You know, he understands the game, I'm sure. And so I think he's able to milk that and to rebound off of that. But it's really scary that this guy, like, all jokes aside, it's really frightening that this guy's our mayor. Like, you know, I make jokes, say my boy, but it's like, yo, our mayor maybe smokes crack. He's done all these things. He has these really backwards views.
Yeah,
you know?
The homophobia, the racism,
but the irony is that's misogyny. That is part of what got him elected, right? Yeah. In the last election. I remember, you know, I was at the barbershop, you know, I don't cut my hair, I hang out at the barbershop, you know what I mean? And people were like, well, you know, Smitherman's this way, so I'm not going to vote for a man who's like that.
Yeah.
I'm going to vote for this guy. You know, and it's like, you realize that, you know, he's kind of, at least he's not gay. You know, it's like, that was the appeal of Rob Ford. He's not gay, so vote for him. It's kind of like, that's odd. So even in terms of his misogyny and homophobia, these things, for some people in Toronto, we like to think of Toronto as being this liberal, artsy place. It is. There's some very right-wing conservative streaks in Toronto.
But I think that it speaks to several things. I think, you know, there are a lot of there's a lot of right-wing power in Toronto, but a lot of activists, I think, are so disillusioned with the system. You know, a lot of people maybe didn't vote.
A lot of people didn't vote.
So I just don't know how reflective of Toronto Rob Ford.
I think a lot of the people who we think of as activists or liberal, they actually have, or like, you know, minorities, air quote again, they often have very sharp conservative values. Like, who buys the Sun newspaper, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at that, it's primarily people of color, mm-hmm. right? Who buy the Sun. And I remember reading like Christy Blatchford back in the day and all these horrible things and all that, but it's still...
Please don't say that name on the show ever again.
Another one of my friends, right? But yeah, so it's like there's this kind of double element where you do have this kind of strange contradiction of people who you think would be invested in kind of more left-wing or leftist type policies, but they're actually very, very conservative in upbringing and background.
Yeah. I think for me, the left, because I basically blame the left of why Rob Ford got in. There was no opposition. I knew he was winning from July when I saw him on the truck at Caravana. I was like, it's over. And they had no candidate till September. I remember that. I was like, he's going to win. So, and I think there's some kind of like, you know, form of elitism within the left that, you know, we don't want to look at why he's so populous within, you know, certain communities in Toronto. And I think we actually really have to look at that.
Well, I think he was towing a line that appealed to a lot of hardworking folks, right? Cutting the gravy.
Yeah. And stopping the gravy train.
Stopping the gravy train. I mean, that was like, you know, music to a lot of really hardworking folks' ears who resent the tax dollars that are, you know, that they pay. And I think that it, you know, it's really easy to lure people with that kind of rhetoric. And that's one of the lures of the conservative political system, right? Is that it always sounds really good for the economy, yeah, and for the bottom dollar and the bottom line. But
and then so like then the response is like when you know he does get in power, oh well, Torontonians are stupid. You know what I'm saying? Like that's what comes out of the left, and I have a problem with that. There's reasons why people, you know, are drawn to certain things, and maybe we need to look at that seriously.
I mean, if you look at like politics, you look at, you know, Baby Bush and Papa Bush, right? Papa Bush is like some like Rhodes Scholar, like some freakishly academically accomplished genius man, ran the CIA for 25 years. And he just seemed like a regular dude. Like, he's not breaking out five-syllable words. He's just like, well, you know, da-da-da-da, talking really slow and not putting anybody off. So people gravitated to him. And then W, who people had up as stupid, he's not that. But, like, everyone was like, oh, I can't believe this guy's the president. He's so stupid. But that was his appeal. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's this kind of snob factor on the left sometimes that blows up in our faces because we don't appreciate that everyday people just want an everyday person, you know, whereas we looking for someone who's like so accomplished and so whatever. And there are people like that, but they don't necessarily present that way. Mm. And they run and they're able to, you know, push people's buttons and get into office, you know. And so I think that's what Ford's been able to do. And it's amazing that he's been able to do it with so many flaws. And he continues to do it, but it speaks to the power of whatever it is he's selling because people are buying it.
But this is that actually brings me back to my original sort of question of this discussion is, you know, I notice that when it comes to the right, they can really do whatever they want and people still forgive them and sort of overlook it. But if any of that kind of stuff happens on the left, it's a very
standard.
It's a completely different reaction, right? Mm-hmm. There seems to be this collective, social collective want for accountability from the left. But if you know, if there's major mess ups happening on the right, it's like people kind of shrug, or I don't know what happens.
Well, yeah, I think that's because the right is the party of power. That's business, industry, military, mm-hmm. and like those are the things that, you know, people want status and people want easy life, and those are the industries that we believe provide those things. So we're going to elect someone who's going to make it easy for those things to function. Now, if somebody's going to go against that, they better be near perfect. And if you're not, then we're going to get you out and put somebody in who either, not even someone who is, you had your crack at it. We're going to put someone who's going to make it easy for, you know, who really runs things. And like that's been the, I think, again, the appeal of the Fords and the Bushes and whoever else for most people. And it's like there's a lot of writing on the historic weakness of the left in North America and how it failed to develop in certain kind of ways because of the dominance of some of the industries I just named and the mentalities of this place where you have people who come here and it's kind of like, you know, they select who comes here to a large part, right? So you have people who are already enfranchised who are looking to hold on to their wealth, right? So they're not necessarily going to go crazy with the lefties. And then you have people who are coming here to work and climb this ladder that those people built. So they're not really trying to necessarily do that. And that's kind of some of the politics of North America and why the left wing hasn't developed the way that it has and why it has to be on such a tightrope. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, you had a question around specifically for Bishara.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was a journalist question, actually, because the article that came out, was it yesterday or the day before? Anyways, whenever the story broke, the Star, you know, at first they just published this. The Toronto Star has seen the video, more to come. And when they, you know, they had this article and accompanying the article was a video of the two journalists who had seen the video. Mm. But in the article, there was one part, and I had posted on Facebook because it was, and Adrian, you actually posted something about this as well. This one part of the article, it was just this one little paragraph, kept referring to the person who was trying to negotiate the sale of the video as the Somali man.
The Somali man. The Somali man.
Every single time he was referenced as the Somali man. Huh. And like, I get it the first time, maybe even the second time if you've talked about some other people and for reference, but it was like every single time, the Somali man, the Somali man, the Somali man. So I had just posted something about, you know, oh, in case you can't decode the racism here, this is kind of racist.
Well, yeah. Like on CNN did the same thing. They're like, you know, Rob Ford is smoking crack with Somali drug dealers.
That's right, right, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. They don't hide it, you know?
Yeah, with Somali, yeah. So then this debate started. Two people got into, you know, went in on the comment section about how this isn't racist. It's, you know, they're just talking about their nationality and la la la. And I'm like, again, I get referencing it the first time, mm-hmm. but every single time. So I guess my whole thing was, do you see that as a nationhood way of identifying through their nationality or through their ethnicity? Just you personally. I mean, I see it as racist, but that's just my opinion.
Identifying like them, the guy identifying himself, or
no,
the
journalist
identifying
him as the Somali man every time he was referenced in the article.
Yeah, I think it's very racist. The fact that, I mean, this man could be nameless. That's like, and they usually are. But the whole thing about the Somali man, the Somali man, the Somali man, the Somali man. I don't know. I think it's this narrative of like, how black masculinity is constructed, mm-hmm. and presented, and in how it's presented in terms of like threats of violence or threats of like threats, right? And so just constantly referencing the black man or the Somali man or the Jamaican man to fearmonger in that way.
Mm-hmm. And sort of on that note is like, you know, this person's going to bring down Ford. You know what I mean? Like
the Somali man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The picture, I'm just curious, the picture that they have up with Rob Ford, there's two places that are blurred out, but there's one that isn't.
Yeah. I noticed that too.
I just thought it was weird.
I noticed that
too. Just a random note.
Yeah, it was weird.
I'm like,
And what is that all about?
Yeah, just,
yeah.
You know, there's a, I mean, there seems to be a story there, you know, like a real story. So I wonder, you know, my little conspiratorial David Icke mind is going, right? And it's like, it's like, I feel like they're stalling things to like put Ford under more pressure to see what's going to pop up. Because like, if the video is there, someone could slap down the cash and we could all be seeing it and making our decision or whatever, right?
And the thing is what it's suspect to me is like how it was leaked. It's very strategic.
Yeah.
They go to the Star and they already know that there's opposition with the Star. They just show the video. Like, they're not like...
Well, they said that they were resistant to show it more than once.
And it was the Gawker, actually, who broke it.
Yeah, exactly.
It wasn't the Star. Although the Star apparently saw it back in March.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, so this... what did they publish? Because the article said something about... Oh, I can't remember. Anyways, it was back in March. That's when they had first been approached by the Somali man.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then something happened where one of the, it was like his dealer got killed or something, and that's how the story even progressed even more or something like that. It was the story of his alleged dealer. Sorry, they could sue me, but blood from a stone, all that, right? But, you know, so there's a lot going on here. It's like, who's
that's
exactly
something
the mayor
that
hanging?
We don't know. There's a lot of missing holes in this story anyway.
It's a huge story. And like you say, there's so, there are so many different avenues.
Lots of question
of
marks.
Story.
But they've raised $55,000 since like last night.
Since on that campaign?
Yeah.
For people who are trying to raise the money to get the video.
Yeah, it's called Crackstarter. It's so.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Wow. Like, they call the Indiegogo Crackstarter.
All you guys are telling me is that I have the wrong friend. I need to be hanging around. Yo, 50 grand in a day, yo?
No,
what are you telling me?
A few hours or something.
A few hours. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, my goodness.
I might have to do a Facebook purge like I did. I need some new friends. Word up.
Let's move on to a better campaign that we should be supporting.
Yes.
I think... Bashar, you should promote yourself a little bit more.
Yeah,
okay.
For your Alphabet project.
Please.
In a cave in Turkey. Coolest thing ever.
So the campaign is on Indiegogo and it's called the Alphabet Project in Turkey. And there's, at this point, I think there's 34 or 33 days left. I haven't checked since yesterday, so I don't know. But yeah, that's it.
So if y'all can come up with 55 grand for a video that can help homegirl
might
out.
Might be there.
Yeah, you know. Could be like, someone was saying it could be an old Chris Farley video for all we know, right?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, somebody already.
That's not me. I said
somebody
said that.
Somebody already did that joke.
Okay. I didn't know that.
I gave credit. I didn't say it was me. I said somebody already said that.
Oh, okay, I thought that was your original business right there.
Oh. I would never think of anything like that.
No, never.
Was he actually in a band?
No. So, sorry, I want to tweet this. So this is the Alphabet Project on Indiegogo?
Yeah.
Or the Alphabet Project in Turkey?
The Alphabet Project in Turkey.
Okay, so Vibe Collective is tweeting that right now.
Awesome. Thank you.
And, so you're going to be there from August until September, you said.
Mm-hmm.
And then what are you doing with this alphabet once you've got it? You mentioned you're going to have some wood stamps maybe. Mm-hmm. And
I think creating a new alphabet is going to take me a long time. It may be a year, it may be more. So it's just kind of starting the research and knowing which direction I'm going to be taking with the development. But I'll be working on it when I come back here as well. Mm-hmm. And working towards those instructional videos as well as those stamps. I actually should have said this earlier, but I'll say this now. So when the alphabet was chosen, I think, to be Latin in 1974, the way that it was spread was through... enforcement and violence. There was a few people that were resistant to it for different reasons. I think there was some people that were like pan-Africanists and were like, no, we should make something up that's reflective of us. And that was one group. And another group was religious and they were like, Arabic is fine, let's just stick to that. And apparently there was protest and some of the protesters were killed, and I'm thinking that the protesters were the religious people, so there wasn't that much of anybody raising any kind of resistance after. And how it was taught in the schools, but it was also spread to rural areas by sending these alphabet ambassadors who are young people, like between 14 and, I don't know, 14 and 30, who would just show up and write letters in the sand to nomads and to farmers. And I that's think it's kind so of interesting amazing. Because it's, like, for them, it was very abstract. And to me, that's also very abstract mm-hmm. because I remember being taught the English alphabet by my uncle when I was a kid and him saying A is for apple. And I'd just be so confused and be like, what is A and what's an apple? Yeah.
Wow. That is so amazing. Profound. Just the thought of how, you know, this knowledge can be shared through something like, you know, going and writing in the sand, that's just beautiful.
And the important first thing is to be culturally relevant, right? Because mm-hmm. A is for apple. If you don't have apples where you, like, what's the point of that, right?
And what's an A if you don't even say A, but you say, like, ah.
Right.
Yeah. Kim is having a moment.
I have lots of moments.
Meme's having a moment.
Meme is having a moment.
Okay, well, we've just got about 6 minutes left in the show. Do you want to talk about any of your other work that you might have coming up? Or is there anything else that you would like to share with us?
I want to plug my uncle, who's gone in the way of the ancestors, but he did work that was kind of foundational to the work that I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. So my uncle, Urfaja Marurfa, rest in peace. He came to Canada in 1991 and was a very ambitious man. Like, he was very ambitious in the sense that he was a civil engineer and came here as a refugee and decided to open up a business. But also noticed that there was, like, all of these Somali refugees that spoke Somali and went to school and accessed all of these programs, but had a hard time communicating with the English-speaking people that they were traveling to and fro and like that were in their lives suddenly. So he made a Somali English dictionary that had Somali on one side and English on the other, and he lived with us for a bit. So I had all of these dictionaries and boxes in my parents' home that I took a whole bunch of. And so it's been a resource for me in terms of, like, when I forget words, I look in the dictionary knowing and kind of am amused by knowing that my uncle intended it for Somali speakers to learn English better. But for me, it's to remember Somali better. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me.
It's been really great having you. And you'll definitely have to come back in September when you come back.
Oh, thank you.
From the cave.
I'm honored. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, there was a moment here in this, a sad moment in the studio.
Yeah.
Good thing it's radio.
Yeah. Can I make an announcement?
Go for it.
So traumatized. So our girl Zainab, although we can't be there right now, if you're close to the Eglinton West area and I don't have my glasses on, is doing a workshop called The Science of Justice, Self-Care, Relationships, and Community Building. It's happening until 5 p.m. today at Accents Bookstore, which is 1790, that's 1790 Eglinton Avenue West. And it is a free interactive workshop to develop a scientific case for social justice, take your self-care skills to a whole new level, transform your work and personal relationships, and be more effective and productive. So there's a number there, but just go to Accents if you're around.
Yeah, and this is something that Zainab did when she was here with us. She did a little bit of some of her workshop exercises, like long fingers.
Yeah.
And she's also doing a dinner dialogue on May 20th at Glad Day.
Yes.
And it's Pay What You Can. And I really encourage people to check that out as well. Awesome. Zainab is amazing. And the book is amazing.
Yes.
Yeah. The book is really, really fantastic. Any more announcements before we go to the break and then music?
Rest in peace to Elijah Harper.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Elijah Harper is a really important voice for Indigenous people in the Meech Lake Accord, as well as other work that he's done in elders. So definitely rise and journey for him. And I feel like there was another passing that we're missing.
Well, Malcolm Shabazz was killed.
Yes, yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Really, yeah.
Yeah.
Tragically in Mexico. So, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a lot of questions around that. Definitely a lot of questions around that. And we missed that last week. So, thank you for that. Yeah. Once again, Bashar, thank you so much for coming to speak with us today on the Vibe Collective.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was really, really illuminating. I'm looking forward to hearing about your experience in the cave and obsessed with the cave. and seeing, you know, what the work is that you come out of the cave with.
Cool. Thank you.
So you're listening to the Vibe Collective. We're going to go to a break, and then I'm going to start off the set, me being DJ Jams, of Music to Move You, and followed by DJ Griffin, also known as Adrian Morrill.
Every time.
So stay tuned here on the Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Derek.